We lie at California. When I was in the Army, in the American Army, I studied Arabic in California. That was an experience. I joined the Army and got sent to Monterey, California. What a lousy place to have to go. The downside of it was it was 8 hours a day in a little room with an Arab trying to learn Arabic. Language universals. We're going to talk about universals of language. We're going to talk a little bit about linguistic terminology. And I'm going to wrap the whole thing up with some information about the Summer Institute of Linguistics, the largest linguistics organization in the world. Here in the United States, we know it as the Wycliffe Bible Translators. Why would we want to study language universals? Linguistics is the scientific study of languages. Linguists use the scientific method. You collect data, you organize it, you analyze it, you make some generalizations or some hypotheses about it, and then you do experiments to see if you can confirm or deny these generalizations you've made. And by looking at linguistics, we can and languages in general, maybe we can bring some information to bear on those languages that we're concerned with, Greek and Hebrew and English. This guy named Bernard Kalm, he wrote a book called Language Universals and Linguistic Typology. Prior to his book, there was a book that was a collection of articles written by Joseph Greenberg, and that was written in the 60s. And that really set the linguistics world on edge because it's actually stating that there were such things as language universals. And Comrie wrote his book in 81 and then revised it in 89. He makes a comment that I think is really interesting. It says, it's clear that the question of explaining language universals has an obvious solution. They are there because they are innate. However, this explanation is never argued for on independent grounds. And so the only reason for accepting innateness seems to be the absence of any plausible, comprehensive alternative. As Christians, I think you and I could give him some reason that it's innate. But he spends a lot of time trying to find plausible alternatives in that book, and there's nothing wrong with that. But as Christians, we might point to Genesis 11:1, which says, now the whole world was one lept, or language, and one set of words. And we might say, well, there's the source of language universals right there. It all started with one language. But then there's verse 9, which says, the Lord confused the lips of the whole earth, or the languages of the whole earth. And we know that our Heavenly Father is powerful enough to really confuse it beyond there being any universals whatsoever. But maybe he didn't do that. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he left universals there because one day he would expect us to take his word to the whole world. Maybe he's not a capricious father. Maybe there's even a better explanation, though, in that maybe the existence of language universals has to do with our humanness, the fact that we were created as in the image of God. But the why of language universals really probably isn't the realm of science and scientific investigation. But there really are some language universals. And as we look at them, they may frankly appear somewhat intuitively obvious. But the really obvious language universals are the things like that there's going to exist in every language a word for water. That's going to be in every language. There's going to be kinship terms in every language. There's going to be terms about our physical world, the clouds, night, day, things like that are truly obvious language universals. But the ones that are interesting are the ones that say something about how languages work. And languages are expressed using a limited range of sounds. Now, one of the things that may limit the sounds, and I'm going to have trouble with this all night. These all stick together. One of the things that that may limit the sounds in a language is the fact that we make them with the organs of speech. I mean, I really can't make a vowel that sounds just like a clarinet with my mouth and nose. I can't. Maybe someone out there can, but the everyday person can't do that. Now, in the realm of linguistics, the study of the sounds of languages is known as phonetics. So we analyze the speech sounds. The whole realm of sounds that the human speech organs can make consists of this study. The study of phonetics also includes, well, what sounds can be made together. And there's a theory of known as generative phonetics, where linguists will analyze if this sound is made in the word, we can generate a theory that will say the sound before it can be this set of sounds, and the sound after it can be this set of sounds. And that may be useful. I'm not real sure where. Probably out in the field when a linguist is trying to analyze some language that has never been analyzed before, he may be able to use some of those theories, but oftentimes, as in many scientific endeavors, the experiment, that, meaning what happens out in the field, proves that the theory didn't work anyway. So sometimes I wonder about some of the fields of study in linguistics. The sounds that a particular language will have are called the phonemes for that language. Now, in English, you're familiar with all the phonemes that we have because you use them every day. In Greek, you guys have been talking about Greek. You have some phonemes that we don't have in English, like the kh sound. In Arabic, they have a phoneme that we don't have. They have a long vowel. In other words, to say an uh and to say an uh, two different lengths of the vowel, that's phonemic in Arabic. Also, they have some different consonants. The ayin, which is made by going like that, that's a phonemic consonant in Arabic. Betty McCauley gave me a tape to look at. She recorded it off of public station here in Kansas City Friday night. And there was a beautiful black lady singing on there. And she was from they didn't say this on there, but I know she was from the Bantu family of languages over in Africa, because in the Bantu languages are the only ones in the world that have clicks in their language. And while she was singing, she kept doing this sound. It was really kind of neat. You never get to hear anybody do that in a phonetic string. Tones. I have an example of tone. You've heard of tone languages, probably. When I was at the University of Iowa, I had to take a field linguistics methods class, and we had this man who was educated at Oxford, but he was from Nigeria, and he spoke Yoruba. Now, Yoruba is a well-developed language. They have, you know, they have a history, and they have a poetry, and it's a well-developed language. And so the idea was we'd sit in the room with him and we'd try to elicit words from him and make up a card file. We weren't told ahead of time that Yoruba is a tonal language. And I had a piece of fruit with me and I held it up and he said the word for it. And I can't exactly remember, but I think it was something like Hongbo. Well, and I said it back to him. I said, Hongbo? And he looked at me real strange and he said, Hongbo. I said, Ongbo? He said, young man, I know that you're not, and he said his beautiful Oxford English, I know that you are trying to say what I said. Ongbo is the word for peach. The word that you're saying is a part of the anatomy that I won't say in mixed company. So tonal languages, you have to, just changing the pitch is, but that's phonemic in that language. The pitch is carries a lot of weight, so it's what the term phonemic applies. Now, I might point out the next one here. all languages group sounds into units. Now, at that point, we come up with morphemes. Now, morphemes are sound clusters that carry meaning in a language. I might write on here the Z sound in English. That Z sound that we use an S for some reason, that is a morpheme in English. It's called a bound morpheme in that it only exists when it's put onto another morpheme. The morpheme for a cylindrical metal object. And when it's put onto a morpheme like that, it carries some meaning. And of course that meaning is the plural meaning. That's what that little morpheme there, the Z sound on the end of that, cans. You'll notice right away that's a Z sound, but we use an S with it. Did you notice that? Cans. We don't say cans, do we? It's a Z sound. That's because the English language, the alphabet of the English language, isn't phonemic. Okay? So we use this and we use this for the same sound in English. It's not phonemic. If we had a phonemic alphabet, we would use something like that for when we were going to write this word. Okay? Instead of writing this. So you get the concept of what a phonemic alphabet would be. My favorite word when writing in a non-phonemic is this one. You take the F of laugh and the O of women and the sh of nation and you get fish. Nice language we have, isn't it? Anyway, morphemes are the little sound clusters that carry meaning in a language. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but you notice that you guys have been working with Greek. To give you there's the morpheme for river, and you'll put this bound morpheme on the end of it. That is the, nominative singular. And if you wanted to put the nominative plural morpheme on the end, potamoi would be the morpheme that would show the nominative plural. So in what you call case endings in Greek, the linguist would call a morpheme, a bound morpheme. Now, the technical term for studying the way morphemes work in a language is morphology. And if you were to take a standard Greek class in college, your first year of Greek, you would spend going through a Greek grammar book, and mostly what you would be learning is the morphology. How to parse a verb, how to decline a noun, and mostly what that consists of is just the morphology of a language. Number three, the third universal, basically that's sentences and clauses. That's the way we think of it. The true form of language isn't what we see written on a piece of paper. The true form of language only consists of something that comes out of the mouth and is heard by an ear. What we write down on paper, what we have printed in books, is just a representation of that. And people really don't speak in perfect sentences. I don't know if you've noticed that before. So the reason that we don't say all languages have sentences is because they don't. I mean, we don't talk like that. Some people are better at that than others, obviously, but we don't talk about that. All languages have distinguishable methods for inquiry, command, and statement. You've been working with Greek. An idea there would be that would ask, where do you abide? And that word right there would be a distinguishable way of asking a question. That's the word for where. And what did he say? And then we'll see a little later, I won't do it right now, but we'll see a little later a use of the negative. In Arabic, they use this word right here. Go on the line like that. That word there, hal, of course you all knew that meant hal. I didn't have to say it. That's pronounced this, hal. That means, that's a question. It doesn't have any meaning. It just means it's, what follows it is going to be a question. In Hebrew, that word, or that rather morpheme, ha, is the question marker. English, of course, we have what is known as the tag question, where we make a statement and then put didn't you at the end of it. You went to the store, didn't you? That's one of the most common ways of asking a question in English, the tag question. And another one is that there are at least two word categories. Now, that might expand on that a little bit. The two word categories would probably be best shown as actions and things. We would maybe call them verbs and nouns. And if we did that, we'd want to break the nouns into two different things in the way that they're used. In the most simple sentence, where there's a verb, a subject, and an object, like Tom hit him, or Tom hit Bob, something like that. There would be a verb and a subject and an object. Now, if you take all the logical permutations of verb, subject, and object, and in English, you would say, Tom hit Bob, okay, subject, verb, object. That's the second most common word order in the world. Unfortunately, English is second class in that. Okay, we're the second most common. The most common is subject, object, verb. Most well-known language that I have found in the literature is Turkish. That means that there's a lot of obscure languages out there that use subject, object, verb. Verb, subject, object is what both Greek and Hebrew are. So the Lord chose the third most popular version for his languages. And then the verb, object, subject, they found one language like that so far. The language of Malagasy, which is spoken on the island of Madagascar. That's that big island just off to the east coast of Africa. And object, verb, subject, there are a few languages down in the Amazon basin that the Summer Institute of Linguistics have found. One of them is called Hicks-Kiriana, and they have that word order. And there are no known languages of the object, subject, verb, although preliminary observations in some of the remote areas of Africa, they think they may have found one. But there's some logical problems with those, to put the object up front. I mean, it's like your brain just doesn't want to do that. So there may be a reason that those are really, really obscure. The next language universal is that all languages have word classes. This is worded strangely. All languages have word classes to allow modification of word classes. And basically what that is saying is that we have things like like gender. And in, for instance, in Greek, we have a highly developed case system that we can use. In English, for instance, gender really only exists in the pronouns. You know, you don't think of a verb, or I mean, a noun form that is particularly gender related in terms of male femaleness, other than obvious ones that refer to that particular gender. But you don't see a verb form that table is inherently feminine or something like that. However, in Greek, you have that. You also have that in Hebrew, but it's just a classification. I mean, it doesn't say that the people in those languages think that particular object has any sex to it. It's not the way they view it. It's just a classification. The concept of gender, though, although both Greek and Hebrew work with gender based on feminine, neuter, masculine, the Wantuat language of the Papua New Guinea has what is known as shape gender. All of their nouns have an ending or a form that fit into one of 16 shape genders. So every noun is going to have a form that would mean like long and cylindrical or amorphous or, yeah, Bob's sitting back there going like this. But all of them have a shape gender. That's a rather strange one. There are African languages that have animacy as the gender, animacy, whether something is animate or inanimate. Human, non-human is also a fairly common classification. In the Japanese language, the classifications that they use really aren't attached to a particular word. It's attached to how the word is used in a sentence. They'll have a topic and a comment. The topic will be what is being spoken about, and then the comment will be the rest of the sentence. And they'll have markers in the sentence so you can tell what is being spoken about. Phonological markers. Maybe the topic is the old or the given information, and the comment will be whatever is changed or whatever is new. You remember in our universal number 3, we said that there are brief sequences of speech that are used to express ideas. You know, typically in the everyday speech act, you don't have anybody that, well, I shouldn't say that. I'm a salesman. I do it myself. Who just rambles on and on. But you know, if if you listen to a person, even if he's rambling, most of the time, he's not allowing too many things to be said before he changes the noun and verb again. And there's a reason for that. And I'll show you a couple of examples in English of why it works like that. I got this from got these sentences from Jacobs and Rosenbaum, and these sentences were written in the late 60s. I think this is a kind of a proto-liberal example of the textbooks from the late 60s, but nonetheless. You'll notice the first one, Dr. Johnson disliked Lady Montague, only tolerated women who understood their subordinate role in society and took delight in insulting women who were thought by him, and that him is obviously referring back to Dr. Johnson. Okay. Now, in the second one, you have the he is supposed to refer to Dr. Johnson, but it just doesn't work, does it? And it's not because the he comes first, because in the third example, there we have he referring to Dr. Johnson, and it does come first. So it's not a matter of whether they come first or second. It's how much junk is in between them. Okay? So there's a different thing operating here than there is here, a different rule operating. Then it really comes down to how much junk is in between it. Put enough in there, and it's the term obfuscation, and I just love it. I mean, you've completely obfuscated things in there to where, you know, it no longer makes any sense. So that's why the concept of brief. Now, here we are using all sentences have a class of proforms. Okay, that was the whole idea of bringing that up. and there we're having the pro-form he, the pronoun. Okay. There's also, in English, we have another pro-form besides the pronouns. And you've probably not really thought about this, but other languages have this too, and you haven't probably been told this. But if I would have point and I would say, who is, what's the next word that comes out of my mouth? Who is he, right? Okay, that's a pronoun. Well, what is he? That's a proverb, all right? But we don't call it proverbs because we already have that word and it means something different. So we just don't call it anything and we just ignore the fact that we have them. But they do exist in languages. Now, let's look at the eighth universal. No, let's not look at the eighth one. Let's look at the ninth one instead, and just to act as if I didn't show you number eight yet. Languages have the means of deleting obvious repetition. Really, what that comes down to is the proforms on a larger level. I've used different fonts here, italics and different font, to show the references. John plays in the sandbox every Thursday, but Mary never plays there, which refers back to the sandbox. Then, which refers to every Thursday. Okay? Those are proforms, really. John likes to dance, and so do I. That's just a way of deleting obvious repetition. All languages can do that. And having said that, I want to read a statement from Ronald Langacker. Ronald Langacker is a linguist from the University of California at San Diego, I believe. He writes, claims that primitive languages have very small vocabularies, that they have no grammar, that most of their words are onomatopoetic, that they cannot express abstract ideas, and so on, are just plain false. He goes on to say, just as there are no primitive languages, there are no corrupt languages. Languages change, but they do not decay. The concept there is every language, we know how complex our language is, but every language is equally as complex. And if you were to see some of the strange things that the minority languages, the languages out in the jungle do with their words, you think Greek is hard. I mean, these people, well, the concept of shape gender, I mean, that's just beyond my, I would have never thought of that. And the thing that makes me wonder is, how in the world did they discover that? You know, I know how. I mean, it took them 16 years to discover it, but nonetheless they did. So, all languages have the means of expressing negatives. That's obvious. Every language is going to have that, but I think the thing that's interesting about it is that it's the diversity of it. If we were to write this negative in Greek, and in this verb form, which is in the indicative, this is a copulative verb, or a linking verb. That plus the indicative always expects a positive answer. So ou plus the indicative in a question in Greek, you're going to get certainly. Well, of course, that's the kind of answer you're going to get. However, if you take this negative and you make the rest of the sentence the same, iskarateroi esmenautu, then you're going to expect a negative answer. So that one would be, well, of course not. That would be the answer that you would expect from that. So it's obvious that all languages have negatives. The interesting thing is how diverse it is. And in English, we have the tag questions where we put a didn't you at the end. and number 10. All languages demonstrate morphemic structure. Really what that says? What that says is for every language, grammar. That's what it says. That no matter how many different morphemes they have, no matter how many changes they put to it, if you study it long enough, you'll find out that it has a regular structure. There may be irregularities. Every language has irregularities. But every language has regularities that you can discover. Now, sure. When I was in the Army, I ended up as an instructor, where the guys that graduated from the language school would be sent to me and in the Arabic language, the Army guys, I would teach them what the Army wanted them to do with their language, and what we found out. And every one of the Russian, the guys that did it for the Russian students, the guys that did it for the Chinese students, we all found out something. We'd play a string. What I did was classified work, but you can kind of imagine that, you know, we were listening to the languages that we were working in. And you'd play a string of Arabic or whatever language, but in my case Arabic, we'd play a string to them, and they'd listen. And they'd write it down. And I'd ask them what every word in that sentence meant. And they knew every word. They heard it, wrote it down, they knew it. Okay, now what does it say? I don't know. And so I went to my boss, who was a Chinese Mandarin. He had been trained in Chinese Mandarin. I said, you know, I'm having this problem. He says, yeah, so am I. He says, we all have it. I said, well, what's going on here? So we got to sitting around, and I was the Arab, we had a Spanish guy, we had a Serbo-Croatian, we had a Czech, a Korean, Chinese Mandarin, a couple of Russians. We got to talking about what was missing. And what was missing is they had the lexicon. Their instructors had done a good job of giving them the lexicon. They didn't know how to tie it together. They didn't know, and they knew how it was operating. And, you know, if there was, in the case of Russian, where there's some case involved, like there is in Greek, there's, you know, case endings, and there were some case endings, and they could tell you what the case ending meant. But they didn't know the syntax. They didn't know what tied it all together and made sense out of it. And so we were asking one another, well, you know, how do you say in Chinese, for instance, how do you give us the present tense? And he'd give us that. Well, how do you do direction? Well, here's how you do direction. Well, how do you do, what kind of conjunctions do you have? And we started making a list of all these things that really don't have anything to do with the lexicon, with the words in the language. They have to do with how the words go together. And we developed a long list, and we call them function words. Now, I want you to understand we didn't do this on Army time. We did this in the barracks, I'll say that, amongst other places. And we put together this long list, and we decided, you know what these things are? They're function words. And they're not always words, they're function concepts, but they're the functions of the language. Now, we call them that, they're really syntax. But, you know, in every language that I've ran into, and I'm sure it's true, I mean, I haven't found this as a language universal, but they all have function words. They all have little words. We call them prepositions a lot of time. There's a lot in Greek. A lot of the function of the language is wrapped around prepositions in Greek. It is in English too. Conjunctions, but not all languages have prepositions. But they all of those things carried the meaning of the language. We ended up, when we got out, all of us got out about the same time, putting together a little company called it Technical Language Systems. And we took this concept that we developed over a few beers and wrote it down. And each one of us sat down and developed what we called a criterion. If you know these functions in the language and you know any set of lexical items, you can operate in the language. Because the lexical items will change. If you know history,
or if you know tank battles, or if you know geography, any of those sets of lexical items can be plugged in to this set of function words, and you can use the language. And then we took that set of function words, and we developed a criterion referenced exam. That was a big thing back then, criterion referenced exam, to where you didn't have to know any lexical items. We gave you those. You just had to, you had to know which function word did what, or which particular functional concept we were presenting in that question did what. And then what we do? We sold it back to the Army. So thank you very much. You all paid your taxes well for that. But it, and it worked, and the Army's still using it today for some of the... any preposition is a function word. Any conjunction, a preposition like, I went to the store. If you don't know what that to, the I went and store really doesn't mean a lot unless you know what that to is. I mean, you have to have the to in order to get all those to tie together. Any conjunction, and... If you don't know what the how the conjunction fits in the sentence or what it actually means, you're not going to catch what all those lexical items do to each other. So that possession, you know, the apostrophe S in English, it's done other ways in other languages. That would be one. Relative pronouns, the which and the that and the who, those are all functions or function words. Tense and aspect. You know, past, present, future, aspect, complete or not complete, those kind of things are all functions. And they can all be tested for, and you don't have to have a lexicon to do it. You don't have to know the actual nouns and verbs to test for those. I mentioned prepositions. In English, we have prepositions. In Japanese, they have postpositions, so it comes at the end. You know, we say to the store, they would say the store to. You know, that they wouldn't say that, but you know what I mean. It comes at the end. And there's a few that have what are known as adpositions that can be either way. It doesn't matter. You put it at front or back, it doesn't matter in that. Estonian is a language that it doesn't matter where you put it. And I have a couple of other universals that I might throw up here. These things all stick together. All languages can modify nouns and verbs. That would be adjectives in English, adjectives and adverbs. I guess Greek and Hebrew, they call them adjectives and adverbs. All languages can change verbs into nouns. The reason it doesn't go the other way is because it doesn't seem to be true that all languages can change nouns into verbs. But an example of this would be changing the verb shrink into the verb shrinkage. You know, all languages can do that type of thing. And trying to be funny here, all languages have a conjunction function. They all can say and, or, if, those kind of things. Now, all of these things, one of the things I find really interesting is that when you read the linguistic textbooks and you read the journals and the articles, you'd think that all the language, or all the linguistic stuff that happens in the universities is the only place it's happening, when exactly the opposite is true. There's so little actual linguistic work that's going on in universities when you compare it to what the Summer Institute of Linguistics does. The Summer Institute of Linguistics is the overseas arm, which is where all the work is done, of Wycliffe Bible Translators. And I have some... I talked about it last night, and I'll bore you with some more statistics here. But I have here, this is called Languages of the World, and it's the Ethnologue. And this is put out by a group within the Summer Institute of Linguistics. Interesting story. During the holiday season of 93, at that time I was acting as the president of the Wycliffe Associates chapter here in Kansas City. And I got a call, and he said, there's a guy in town that you ought to go meet. And he's, I work out in Prairie Village, which is south of here for about 20 miles. And he's, we think he's out in your area because he has the same prefix on his, as you do on your work number. So we'll give him a call. So I called him up. His name was Ted Bergman. And I talked with him for a couple minutes, and he was on furlough. He's most of the Bible translators work for 4 years in the field and then get a year of furlough. Well, this guy every year takes a month off or two and spends it with his family because he's retired from the military. Actually, he was a naval civilian. But what he does for the Summer Institute of Linguistics is he's based in Nigeria, and he's in charge of all of the language surveys worldwide. Now, the language survey, what they do is they take a tape recorder and some long-range provisions on their back, and they go out into the woods or the jungle or the desert, and they do language surveys. They go into a village, and they record what those people sound like. And they take it to the next village, and they play it back, and they see if they understand it. And if they understand it, then we have a concept here of mutual intelligibility. These two, you know, same language, okay? They speak it a little different, but they understand each other. That's called a dialect, okay? Well, they do that worldwide, and they have about 40, 41 people that do that all the time. That's one of the toughest, most demanding jobs there is, because you're gone for months at a time, and you're living off of the land. And they are the ones that come up with this listing of all the languages in the world. This is the 10th edition. We have it downstairs in our library. And it says in here, the Bible Status Translation of the Living Languages of the World. They list 5,445 languages. The 12th edition is out now. And just before I came here, I called the headquarters, and I asked them if they could give me a listing, because I said all I have is the 10th edition. They're saying now that there's 6,528 languages in the world. Now, the concept of the language is important, and you all may be sitting there thinking, are these languages or dialects? By their definition, they're languages. And their definition includes more than just mutual intelligibility. You know, if you think of English, for instance, they call English one language. And I have a book over here that was written in England. And I can read it, and it's English. I can read it well. Well, the English language in the written form is one language. I'll guarantee you in the spoken form it's not, because my little wife from Texas, one time I picked up a guy on the street near our apartment to take him to work with me, because he worked not far from me, and he was from England. When he got out, she looked at me and she says, I couldn't understand a single word he said. There was absolutely no mutual intelligibility there. I mean, she could not understand him. Consequently, they really spoke two different languages. They read one. You get the idea of what a different language is? I mean, if he were to come into our house and sit down and ask my wife what we're going to have for supper, she'd be lost for an answer. Not because she's stupid, it's just she couldn't understand him. The other side of it was, he couldn't understand her, so. But there wasn't any mutual intelligibility. So there's the idea of that, and there's the idea of the written form. A good example of that is, they list, I'm not completely sure about this, I've just read this, that Spanish and Portuguese are two different languages because of socioeconomic reasons. Right? I mean, you can't hand a guy a Spanish book in Kenya that speaks Portuguese. He won't understand it? He won't? Okay. How about, do you know about Norwegian Danish? Do you know about them?
No, but on your Spanish Portuguese, the reverse is opposite.
Oh, is it?
One can understand the other.
Oh, okay. I knew there was something about it.
Portuguese can understand Spanish. Spanish can't understand.
Okay. And but how about in the written form?
Yeah.
You don't know? Okay. But it seems to be a similar thing to English.
Yeah.
Yeah, similar. Okay. I'm told that Norwegian Danish is that way, but they are mutually intelligible. But they call them different languages because, after all, the natives don't want to have anything to do with the Norwegians. You know? And that type of thing, and I kind of made fun of them, and I don't know if that's true or not, but that type of thing exists worldwide where, you know, we don't speak that language over there. Because, after all, that's a, you know, it's a pig language. I mean, we speak that, you know. But in truth, they can understand it, and they do speak it. But so there's a socioeconomic, there's the written form, and in trying to decide whether something is a dialect or not, there's the phonemic level. The reason my wife couldn't understand the guy from Britain was phonemic. I mean, he has, instead of saying a T, he has a glottal stop, you know. He's Scottish, after all. You know, I mean, he doesn't say Scottish. He says Scottish. So it's phonemic. At the phonemic level, that's really dialect. When it gets into the vocabulary, that's really dialect, too. I mean, they would... I don't know British English very, very well, but they had a different set of words, you know, over there. I guess you don't ask for a... well, I don't get it. It doesn't matter. Yeah. What's the word? Yeah. Cigarette. Fag and cigarette. Yeah. Yeah. But when it gets into the grammar, when it's just a few grammatical points, it can still be a dialect. For instance, in Black English, if you go down to the downtown, you'll hear people that don't inflect the verb to be. You know, they'll say, what you be doing, you know? And I'm not, you know, and listen, we laugh about that, but they don't, I mean, linguistically speaking, they don't inflect that verb. But it's still English. Okay, it's still English. But there's not a gross amount of grammatical differences, okay? Not a gross amount of, but when it gets into syntax, when it gets in to how words operate, then there's no doubt that we're operating in a different language, okay? So with those kind of things in mind, socioeconomic, the written form intelligibility, mutual intelligibility, and then these items, that's how they decide. And another thing that they have happen is they go into Village A and they elicit some data, and they take it over to Village B. And there's mutual intelligibility. And then they go to Village C, and lo and behold, there's mutual intelligibility. But then they take the tape that they had in A, and they play it for the people in Village C, and it doesn't work. Now, if you were in charge of placing a Bible translator, where would you place him? B, right? Because whatever he did there, both villages could understand, right? That shows the importance of what Ted Bergman's group does. Because the last thing you want to do is send a guy to spend 25 years of his life living in horrible Stone Age conditions, and he's wasted a lot of time, because if he'd have spent him here, now he's got to go back over here and spend some more time. So maybe another 10 years worth of labor he's going to have to spend translating into that dialect. That's the extremely important activity. As a matter of fact, half of the new recruits into Wycliffe Bible Translators from the United States that are going into the field go to Africa. And they have to sit and wait because they don't have enough done yet. They can't place them because they don't want to do that kind of thing. They don't want to make any mistakes. I met a couple, and I alluded to them earlier, about when we talked about the verb to walk, and we had that little example of that earlier this afternoon. It was Don and Leona Davis, and they in the mid-50s, late-50s, they went into the Papua New Guinea and began work on the Wantawat language. And 16 years later, they finished it up and they went to the Solomon Islands. And they spent some time as language consultants. They were telling me about one of the things that they ran into in in this kind of, you can imagine this happens just daily. If you're working with Stone Age people, and all they know is this little area that maybe 10 miles in diameter. I mean, maybe they've never really gone beyond 10 miles away from their village. And especially if they're in the Papua New Guinea, where it's just the jungle, and you go to 1 Peter 5:8, where it says, the devil prowls about like a roaring lion. Now, they don't know what a lion is, and you have no way of really making them understand. You show them a picture, but it really would have no meaning. They told me that they translated it as a weasel, because they knew what a weasel was, and the weasel would come in and steal their people's poultry. And the whole concept behind this was that the roaring lion was going to steal your spirit. So they did that. At least it had some meaning to the people. Well, they then, after they left and went to the Solomon Islands, all they did was translate the New Testament, leave it. You know, there was a bit of a church that had formed up. I mean, some believers had, you know, in their 16 years, a couple of people had gotten converted. But they didn't, you know, Wycliffe Bible Translators isn't into church planting. I mean, you know, you just give them the Bible and let them run with it, you know. Well, that was in 75 approximately when they left. In 1995, in the early part of this year, they went back over there. And during this time, a church had sprung up. People actually used the Bible and read it, studied it. There was an active church. They had a hymnology. They developed some hymns. The government had found out that part of SIL's charter is to let the government know what they're doing, and the government knew these people were now somewhat literate in their language, so they sent some teachers in there, and they had some textbooks, and the second generation of kids knew what a lion was because they'd had it in school. So they could start on another revision to the New Testament and clean up some things, because now they had an educated, generation had sprung up in the 20 years that they had been gone. Well, one of the things that, and this is kind of a moving thing to me, Don said that, you know, they showed up and there was a few of the people that they knew that were still alive. And he got up and, you know, he went into their church service and he listened to them sing, and, you know, he still remembered the language. He still had a copy of their testament, so he stood up in front of them. And he read from their Bible, and then he preached a sermon. And when he started talking to them in their language, a virtual roar went up in the crowd, because this new generation of people had never heard a white man speak their language. There had never been a white man who had taken the time to learn their language. I guess they'd forgotten that he's the one that translated it. You know, it's a pretty powerful. Some of the things that happen in the world of Bible translators is pretty powerful. And one of the more interesting bits of statistics on Summer Institute of Linguistics is where things are happening. The living languages in Europe, there are 209 languages. That's 3%. In Africa, this tells you why half of the SIL people go to Africa, 1,995, or 30% of the living languages. In the Americas, this is interesting, in our hemisphere, 949 languages. A lot of work to do here, 15%. In the Pacific, 1,341, 21%. And in Asia, 21%. Now, one of the reasons that we say that so many of our people are going to Africa is because virtually every country in sub-Saharan Africa wants SIL to come into their country. Now, see, that's the way SIL works, is that they go in and they make a contract with the government, that in exchange for us going out and giving and teaching your people how to be literate in their own language, developing a grammar and an alphabet, and teaching them how to be literate in their own language, in return for us doing that, you let us translate the Bible into that language. And they make a contract with the government. Now, that's the way SIL works. There are some loose cannons out there. And I say loose cannons in that there are some people that go into places like the Muslim countries, where if you do that, you're dead. If you're caught doing that, you cannot proselytize in a Muslim country because they'll execute you. But there are people that do that. They go, and there are a lot of unwritten languages in Muslim countries, and these people. You got to hand it to them. They have guts. They go in there and live and learn the language and translate the New Testament in the hope that they'll kind of backdoor the Muslims that way. But Africa is wide open right now. The Bible translation status of the living languages. The nearly extinct. This is the living languages that are nearly extinct. There are 336, or 5% of the languages. These are living languages that are near. There's so few people that speak the language. They're really not going to put any effort into those languages. I mean, for somebody to go in and translate the Bible into that language, you know, within two or three generations, there won't be anybody to read the Bible anyway. I was mistaken last night. I was kind of shooting for my hip when Chester asked me this one. The number of languages that actually have the Bible is only 4% of the languages. They have the entire Bible in their language. The number of languages that have the New Testament ...10% of the languages have at least the New Testament. And then the work in progress. Of course, that's changing. I mean, that. And the other category. To give you some idea, there's 62%. To give you some idea of what that means, 10 years ago, that other category. I have that statistic here. What it was. 10 years ago, definite needs in that they, and this is. The status of language surveys as of 10 years ago, and believe me, a lot has been done in 10 years. They knew they had a definite need of 723 languages to be translated. The Bible would need revision. There were 66 languages. They knew it needed revision. The people really weren't using it because it just didn't speak in their language. There was a probable need of 133 and a possible need of 2,330 languages, and that was 10 years ago. And they've found out that there's another 1,000 languages, and they aren't finished. Ted was telling me that they're probably out of the 6,500 languages. He said there's probably 40% of the work that still needs to be done to know whether or not they're actually languages or dialects, and whether or not they know. In all areas of the geography of Africa, even, let alone Asia, whether or not there are more languages out there that they don't even know about. It's a big job, and you know, Chester made, you know, what does that tell you? Well, he made that statement last night. Well, it tells you two things. It tells you, number one, we have a lot of light, and we also have a lot of work to do. And you know, the interesting thing about Wycliffe Bible Translators is most of the funding is coming out of this country. Well over 85% of the Bible translators are coming out of this country. The big thing that they're doing now is they have enough veteran translators is to spend time now with those veteran translators to teach the nationals how to translate the Bible into their own language. For instance, over in Africa, one of the interesting things about Africa is that they have a lot of well-educated men who are willing to go out and live in their country and translate a Bible, and they could do it. The problem is they don't have a church that can support them. I mean, they don't. It's like we send a missionary out. You know, in our affluent society, we can garner enough support still, you know, to send out some. They don't have anything like that. You know, their societies are truly third world and can't support another guy without him carrying his weight. So the plan now for Wycliffe is to do that, just find ways of supporting the nationals. That's one of the plans that I, and they're working that plan. It is working. The thing that kind of scares me though is the way, you know, to make a political comment, the way our country's going, and we're the one